In America was this, that while right-left distinctions mattered to the parties and politicians, most average folks didn't really care and didn't feel the heat of this divide in their daily lives. Books like United After All by the prominent sociologist Alan Wolf in the late 90s backed up that idea, painting a picture of Americans reaching common ground at the community level, even if they might vote differently on election day. But today, there's a growing body of evidence that the divisions we see on Capitol Hill and on cable TV are trickling down to all of us. Several recent surveys of American attitudes confirm this trend. Alan Wolf himself has even pulled back from his earlier optimism. And our guest today feels the same way. We're talking with Frank Newport. He's editor-in-chief at Gallup. Newport spoke at Dartmouth College last night as part of Dartmouth's Iliad Summer Lecture Series. Newport's been with Gallup for six presidential cycles. He says the public is growing increasingly partisan, with widening fissures along lines of race, age, income level, gender, and especially religion. Today in The Exchange, polling and polarization with Gallup's Frank Newport. And let's hear from you. Do you also see the divides in our state houses and in Congress trickling down to all Americans? Or do you think this idea of polarization is exaggerated? Also, do you see the divide as a net negative for our country? Or is it part of the American tradition to debate and disagree on our core convictions? Give us a call. Tell us what you think. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or post a comment on our Facebook page. And Frank Newport, it's really nice to meet the guy behind the poll, so to speak. Welcome to New Hampshire.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you've been reading the tea leaves of the American body politic for a long time, looking at our political attitudes. What's the biggest difference that you see, Frank, from when you first started at Gallup in the early 90s to today?
Well, I should point out there were divisions back then. In fact, a lot of people point out that we had wildly partisan newspapers, as you may remember, long before my time, but way back in history, where you would choose your newspaper, remember, based on its political orientation. So the idea that we are somehow more divided now is not necessarily brand new. But we are clearly, in answer to your question, based on several different empirical indicators, seeing evidence that Americans are more polarized than they used to be. And we look at it and come at it from the public's perspective in a couple of different ways that I can explain. But nevertheless, it does look like that we have people that are more in one camp or the other now than we might have even going back to the late 80s and into the 90s.
Because the question that pollsters and sociologists have been asking for several years now is this, you know, vitriolic cable TV news partisan sharpness trickling down to all of us? And for a while it was, no, not really.
Mm-hmm. It is. And you know, you said it's trickling down, so you're starting with Congress. You look at the elites, but there is evidence. We talked about it at the Iliad series up in Hanover yesterday. The other presenter there, Tom Edsel, a professor at Columbia, presented a lot of data showing that Congress itself is more polarized. You don't have Republicans and Democrats making moderate votes anymore. In other words, voting is much more divided now based on the party of the representative in Congress than it used to be in the old days, where you'd have people crossing the aisles and voting one way on one issue and the other. Our evidence does, in fact, show that it's trickling down to the people now. A couple of different ways we look at it. We look at Republicans and Democrats and say, do you approve or disapprove of the way the president is doing his job? Our classic job approval rating. And it used to be you would have crossover. You'd have some Republicans saying okay about a Democratic president and vice versa. And now that's been spreading apart. In fact, it looks like for Obama this year, and of course we're only halfway through the year, it may be the second most polarized president that we've had in Gallup history. The only other more polarized presidential year would have been 2004 with the Iraq War so controversial and Bush running for re-election, George W. Bush at that time. But otherwise, the huge spread, it looks like it's going to be about 73% difference between Democrats saying they approve of Obama and Republicans saying they approve of Obama. That's a good measure. We have it back to Eisenhower. And that's one way we can say, geez, you know, if you're a Republican today, that's it. You know, you're not – no Republicans, it looks like, are going to say they approve of Obama, and very few Democrats say they don't. So that's one good measure we have to say, hey, the public's more polarized.
How else do you measure this idea of political divide? That's a good way to measure it, looking at how partisans feel about the president.
Mm-hmm.
How else do you measure it when you talk to people?
Well, another method that we use is to look at people's positions on issues. And some people at some other research companies, Pew Research and some others, have spent a lot of time doing this. And you can track issues, you know, values issues, abortion and gay marriage, In fact, in one study, Pew Research, as I mentioned, they looked at over 40 different issues over the years and saw, well, how do Republicans say they feel on the issue and how do Democrats say they feel? And it was back in the late 80s that you had crossing the aisle. You know, whether you were Republican or Democrat didn't necessarily predict as strongly your position on some of these more controversial values issues. And now the spread's gotten bigger and bigger. So if you're a Republican, it's pretty much we know how you're going to say you feel on same-sex marriage or how you feel on abortion. And if you're a Democrat, the same thing. So that's a second way that we can say, geez, nowadays people are more likely to have their whole life wrapped up in their partisan identity. And once you know what you are, there's no crossing the aisle. And that's an evidence of polarization.
How nuanced, Frank, are these questions about issues or about a particular president? Do you give people a chance to put themselves on a continuum saying, I'm strongly conservative, I'm somewhat conservative. Do you give them a 1 through 10 or 1 through 5, or is it more a yes-no?
Well, a lot of our questions are yes-no. Some of them have nuances to them. One thing we do is we combine questions a lot so we can say, you know, we're not just looking at same-sex marriage as the only question we ask to get a person's position on values and morals issues, but instead we look at a variety of issues. But there are others where we give people scales, where we say, all right, where do you stand from a 1 to 5 scale? We've got some good questions that would do that. So it really varies in answer to your question.
And you told me before the program that you're also a sociologist. So take off the pollster hat, Frank, and put on the sociologist hat, if you could, please. What's behind this? If even as recently as the early 90s, we weren't quite as sharply partisan, what happened in the last 15 years?
You know, everybody asks that question. It's an excellent question. How's that? Next?
You know? Right.
Because we don't have an absolute answer. In fact, there's a question of causality, you know. For example, with the news media, one of the likely culprits that people who look at this constantly bring up is the fact that we have more divisive, except, of course, for New Hampshire Public Radio, which brings in people of all political persuasions. But out there in the real world, we obviously know now, like on cable news at night, which is the number one example, you can pick Fox News if you're conservative and get just straightforward, more conservative. In fact, very, very explicitly partisan conservative politics. And MSNBC, which was kind of late to the party, their executive said, we need some of this ratings too. So the MSNBC executive said, all right, we'll go liberal. And that'll give us some money because everybody's after money in cable news. And they've been able to position themselves more democratically. And then on non-public radio, obviously, with Rush Limbaugh and other talk show hosts, they've been able to do that. And of course, with the internet, people have the capability of exclusively finding sites and information that fits their partisan orientation. But I say it's the chicken or the egg, a causality issue, because obviously Fox News is only succeeding because there are lots of conservatives who are willing to watch and give them the ratings boost that they need. So it's really hard to know, were they tapping into something that already existed? Or did this media division create more divisions? And we don't have any empirical, at least I'm not aware of empirical evidence that really lets us disentangle the causality. But that's
right.
Certainly one likely culprit that people bring up is our exposure to information.
Well, I appreciate you saying that because, you know, if no one wanted to watch these programs that were heavily slanted one way or the other, they wouldn't make any money and they wouldn't exist. So when people complain about the partisanship of the media, it's not going to exist if no one's watching.
Yeah,
so that's
right.
I'm glad you raised that.
And the same thing
point.
for gerrymandering is often brought up as well.
Yes, explain that.
You know, there are 435 representatives in Congress, and more the districts are so-called safe districts where they're more heavily Republican and Democrat rather than mixed districts where, you know, you have a Republican and Democrat who are duking it out and getting about 50% of the vote each. Now it's one or the other. But again, that represents to some degree the fact that Americans have sorted themselves out ideologically and where they live. So as we talked about yesterday, there are some areas where you can't get a mixed district, right? If you go like Massachusetts, which is one of the most Democratic states in the country, or Utah, one of the most Republican, it's hard to find a mixed district.
So we're self-selecting. We're birds of a feather flocking together.
Yeah, you know, we're sorting ourselves more geographically. So again, it's the chicken or the egg. That's another issue that people bring out. We're more ideologically divided in how we put our congressional districts together, but that in part may reflect human beings' behavior here in the U.S. and where they decide to live.
Real interesting. All right, let me invite our listeners to join us, Frank, and then a lot more questions. Our number here in the exchange for you to be with us is 1-800-892-6477. Frank Newport is here. He's editor-in-chief at Gallup. He's been with the organization for almost a quarter century. Yesterday, he spoke at Dartmouth's Iliad Summer Lecture Series about political polarization. Frank's forthcoming book book is called God is Alive and Well, Religion in America, and we'll talk about that in a few minutes. Right now, though, we'd like to hear from you. Do you see the divides that we see on cable TV and at our state houses and in Congress trickling down to the rest of us, or do you think that this idea of political polarization is exaggerated at the community level? Give us a call. Tell us what you think. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org, or you can post your comments on our Facebook page. And you know, Frank, we've done lots of programs on this idea of political polarization. And for sure, people talk about the media, and for sure, people talk about political gerrymandering. I'm wondering, though, is there something else that we're not looking at that's causing this? Are we, for example, grumpy because the economy's been bad for 4 years?
We are grumpy. How's that? Thank you very much. You put your finger on something. That's possible. All of our indicators now are quite low or quite negative. Satisfaction with the way things are going, economic confidence itself, presidential job approval is actually holding up pretty well, but congressional approval is in the basement. A lot of our indicators are very negative, and in part that does in fact reflect the economy. You know, a rising tide economically rises all boats, and a lowering tide lowers all boats. One reason Bill Clinton was able to survive impeachment and Monica Lewinsky was because the economy was so buoyant back in the late 1990s, and people said, forget it, we don't worry about anything now. So I think if the economy was booming, I think we would have less worry about this political divisiveness and people would be more positive. And now that we have all these problems that are perceived in our data by the American public, that probably contributes to it. So that may be a cause as well. Otherwise, people ask the questions, and I'm not sure we know. You know, it may just be for – we're seeing it worldwide. We talk about religion and race and ethnic relations. We're seeing worldwide the evidence that people are retreating more to their, identities, making them more important, their religion and their ethnicity perhaps than in the past. And then this may be part of the phenomenon we're finding here.
All right. Well, more to talk about after a short break. The number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477.
Good morning, it's 9:19. NHPR's annual car raffle is already more than half over. Our grand prize winner will drive away with either a Ford Fusion or a Toyota Prius. That could be you when you get your $50 raffle tickets for your shot at a new car. Call 1-888-805-NHPR or visit nhpr.org to get your tickets today. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Andy Summer Playhouse in Wilton, theater by youth for audiences of all ages, presenting a new musical adaptation of Moby Dick, August 10th to the 18th, andysummerplayhouse.org. From Plymouth State University's College of Graduate Studies, offering an array of educational programs, including new postmaster's higher education options, plymouth.edu/graduate. And from Northeast Delta Dental, providing dental benefits to businesses of all sizes and individuals throughout New Hampshire, Maine, and Vermont. Information online at nedelta.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, Frank Newport is here, editor-in-chief at Gallup. He's been looking at political polarization in the American electorate, and we'd like your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send a short email to exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And Frank Newport, let's go to our callers now. And Kathleen's calling in from Harrisville. Hi, Kathleen. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'd just like to make the comment that I receive a lot of emails from my friends and relatives who are on the left, and my friends and relatives who are on the right, each trying to make their point, and emails that have no basis in fact whatsoever. I actually get emails that, if you don't believe me, check, click this link, and it's a link to Snopes. And I click the link, and the link says it's false. So people are not doing enough research either as to following whether or not a lot of this information is true or false, but all it does is promote the far right and the far left agenda into creating a lot of, fallacies and a lot of just a lot of hateful rhetoric on both sides. And I think it's causing huge divides. I have arguments with my friends all the time that you need to check your facts before you go sending this to 15 other people.
Except these days, Kathleen, nobody believes the fact checkers.
Well, and that's a problem too. But some of these emails are just so ridiculous that to not check them and just, you know, to go ahead and forward it to, you know, to 15 other people or 20 other people is irresponsible.
Okay, Kathleen, thanks a lot for calling in. Great point. Go ahead, Frank.
Very interesting point. The more I look at what I do for a living, which is trying to gauge public opinion, the more I realize is that everything is mixed, right? Which sometimes is boring because you say, well, on the one hand, you can argue this, on the other, that. And so I think the caller is absolutely right that oftentimes things are not clear cut and there are arguments on both sides. And yet, as she points out, that may be part of what we're seeing, that we get more and more very, very highly partisan information that comes forth, she's saying, through emails, but we're talking about it. It also comes through cable news programs at night and certainly on radio talk shows in the commercial sphere and on other internet sites. So it's quite possible for somebody to be bombarded by just this partisan orientation. And she's right. If you don't do your own judicious looking at the data, you begin to believe it and say, geez, you know, I feel very strongly this direction because I'm constantly being reinforced in those feelings. And humans probably have a drive to want to view the world more simply rather than more complexly. So it's kind of nice, maybe mentally, for us to watch a cable news show and just have somebody very simply say, you know, if you're on the right, Obama's evil and that's it, or if you're on the left, to say Romney's evil and that's it.
You know, it's interesting, too. She talks about the emails back and forth, and certainly there's a lot of questionable information in them. You talked about this divide that we see, you know, emerging since the early 1990s. That's about when the internet took off.
Yeah, again,
coincidence or not? What do you think?
Well, here I am being ambiguous. As I said, the more I look at life, the more I realize there's no black and white often. Correlation is no proof of causation. Oftentimes in history, you find two things that occur simultaneously, but they're not necessarily causing one another. But that's absolutely right. We certainly have the internet, and most Americans now communicate, at least in partially, get information and communicate through the internet. And the internet is so vast that it certainly allows us to be more picky or to access things that just reinforce our points. The example that a lot of people raise, and I've heard it so often, is Walter Cronkite. You know, it used to be supposedly that we all, Democrats and Republicans alike, sat around our sets at night and watched Uncle Walter, who would be very down the road, down the middle of the road, giving us very neutral news, and we all therefore shared the same common information, right? And now, instead of watching even the three remaining network news programs, most people, particularly most people that aren't old because those programs skew very old, simply tune on Fox News or MSNBC at night, supposedly, and they're just getting one side of the news. Now, how much that's a factor, I don't know, but that's a nice symbolic kind of metaphor probably for what's going on in the internet. Reflects the same type of tendencies.
Now, what about social media, Frank? First of all, does social media, do you think, that we've seen the huge rise of in more recent years, Facebook and Twitter especially, does that increase the divide or reduce the divide that you see in American public opinion?
Again, very difficult to say we have empirical evidence that absolutely shows it, but that's certainly a reasonable hypothesis. You know, that the fact that we can now access certain Facebook, follow certain Facebook pages and be on follow certain people on Twitter certainly seems reasonable. That allows us to get just one side of the information rather than the other. Now, the caller that we had just a few minutes ago, she may access both sides, right? But a lot of us like to reinforce selective exposure to information, we call it, like to reinforce our pre-existing positions. And if you're a rabid conservative or a rabid liberal, we now have the ability with social media to constantly, with our smartphones, just be reinforcing ourselves because we only access the positions, the social media outlets that reinforce our positions.
I mean, it is more democratic. On social media, you can post your political feelings. It's no longer just organized journalism institutions, politicians, pollsters like yourselves. It's everybody. It's the average mm-hmm. Joe and Jane, and they can say whatever they want, true or not, and put it out there.
That's true. And, of course, a lot of the sites are clearly one side or the other. And as I mentioned, you can access those selectively, and that may increase this whole idea of partisanship. But I would point out, you know, in the old days, prior to social media, you could certainly only associate with fellow travelers, so to speak. You know, if you were conservative, only talk to them interpersonally on the porch or the stoop, you know. And so I'm not sure. That's why I'm saying empirically sometimes, although all of these things seem very reasonable, It's hard to really pinpoint with data that those are absolutely major factors, things like the rise of social media.
Our number again is 1-800-892-6477. You can post a comment on our Facebook page or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Your thoughts, questions, comments on this political divide that Frank Newport at Gallup sees. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Next up is Michelle in Gardner, Massachusetts. Hi, Michelle. You're on the Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura. Thanks. I love your show.
Good.
I think that a really significant factor in the polarization is the rise in power of the religious right. The influence that they wield has increased phenomenally in the last 30 years since basically Reagan gave them a lot more influence. And I think it was Barry Goldwater about 40 years ago who said that if we get a party that is dominated by religion, then we get a party that will not compromise because the folks that are there, because of their religious beliefs, believe that they're speaking for God and there is no room for compromise there.
Michelle, let me ask you a quick question if I could, and thanks a lot for calling in. Is this part of the problem, you know, just blaming the other side for this political divide, not looking at what your own leanings or party may be, because I'm guessing the other side would say the same thing about you, about the left.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm a Reagan Republican and a Catholic, and I have watched in horror as the party has become more and more dominated by religion, because in America, religion and, you know, the state and the church are supposed to be separated. And I think that, in my personal opinion, basically, I consider myself to be a social liberal and a fiscal conservative, so I average out to be moderate. But the party has gone to such extremes, and I really feel like it's imploding. And I feel like what we're seeing in some respects, and possibly with the churches too, is the burst of activity that you see before an institution dies out.
Okay.
I don't think that the Republican Party will go away, but, you know, it basically imploded in the 50s with the Birchers, and I think that's what it's doing now with the Tea Party.
Well, Michelle, I hope you caught our program yesterday where we looked at the idea that there's a war on religion, and we had a good conversation about these concepts of religion and public life, what's too much, what's not enough. Thank you for joining us. Your thoughts broadly, Frank, and then I have a couple other questions for you.
Well, she's tapped on a very, very fascinating area. I deal with it in the book, as you mentioned, that'll be forthcoming in December. We're seeing it worldwide. I think there's no question that the connection between religion and the external world is increasing from what we have seen previously. I say we're seeing it worldwide because a lot of what we're seeing in countries that are predominantly Islamic is this connection between religion and how the state should be run. And I think we've seen more of that. There's no question in this country that religion is more closely correlated with politics. If you are religious in this country today and you're white, excluding for the moment African-Americans who are a very interesting side situation, there's no question you're much more likely to be Republican. So there's a high correlation between religiosity, as we call it, and political identification. And she's right. Religion gives one a feeling of structure. Highly religious people feel you can make right and wrong decisions, that you can say this is right and this is wrong, as opposed to irreligious people who are more likely to say, you know, anything goes, or there's really, it's not appropriate for me to make a decision that one thing's right and one thing's wrong. So we do have highly religious people who are more rigid in their thinking, and they tend to be more Republicans, and they are now spilling out from saying, let's convert people to our religion, to let's convert society to reflect our tendencies. So we are seeing more of it. Whether it's good or bad is an interesting question. In February, President Obama made his prayer breakfast speech, which a lot of people didn't notice, but it was very significant because basically he was saying Jesus would have been a Democrat. President Obama, in some ways, he didn't use those words, mind you, but that's how I read the speech. He was basically saying, hey, we can't leave religion just to the Republicans. If you're highly religious, you actually ought to be a Democrat because of our social justice, you know, the position of caring for the poor, a lot of the things that Christians would believe Jesus stood for, he said, actually manifest themselves more as in a Democratic liberal position. So it looked to me like Obama and his advisors were trying to get into the game and saying, we don't want to be the party of the non-religious. We think highly religious people can be Democrats as well. So we may have more of a war in the future over highly religious people. But in America today, there's no question, like we've seen elsewhere around the world, to sum it up, being highly religious is identified with very strong positions on the more conservative side of the ledger.
How fair is it, Frank, to blame a party or a political movement for these broader political divisions that you're seeing in America today?
Well, it's the same thing, Laura, where it's back and forth. You know, what's causing what? I don't know that it's the party, but clearly the Republican Party took advantage of the fact that you have highly religious people are very valuable in a political sphere because they're motivated, they're easily reachable, and because, as the caller said a few minutes ago, they feel so strongly about their beliefs, they are more likely to turn out and be active. So if you can tap into a highly religious base, it's very productive from a crass political perspective. So it's hard to say what causes what, but the Republican Party clearly, a few decades ago, realized that it was quite smart to align itself with this highly emotional-driven group of people, and therefore it's kind of they're both feet on each other is what it looks like.
Our phone number again on the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Michelle, thanks for that call. The number 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org, or you can post a comment on our Facebook page. And here's an email from Matthew Frank. He says, what about Congress's very low approval rating? How can the approval be so low and the polarization still so sharp? I like that question. Thank you, Matthew.
Yeah, approval rating is terrible for Congress. In fact, I say it's really frightening to me, you know, how last year we did a review at Gallup and found 10 different indicators where either Congress or the federal government were at or near all-time lows in terms of people's respect for the institutions in Washington and also the men and women that we send off to represent us. So they're very, very low. Going along with that, we have an increase in the percent of Americans who represent themselves as independent and not either Democrat or Republican. So we kind of got two trends going on. I think that may be what the person who emailed in was getting at. At the same time that we have perhaps smaller groups of people who are very rabid in their perspective, we have a growing number of cynical people maybe in the middle who say the whole process stinks there in Washington and then I don't want anything to do with it. So it's kind of two different trends that are going on. But let me just give you one statistic. When we ask Americans, how confident are you in institutions, Congress is dead last out of this entire list of institutions of everything we test. And what's at the top? It's the military. So some people scratch their head and say, you know, this would be a very dangerous finding in some countries around the world because that's the exact situation that leads to coups. I don't think we're going to have a coup in this country, but we have very high level of respect for the military and almost no respect for the representative government we have. So it's a fascinating currents that are going on in America at this time.
Well, I'd like to pick up, if I could, Frank, on this independent voter. I mean, it is real interesting. You first of all see this rise in polarization, not just among politicians, but among the public. But like you said, side by side, you see this supposed rise of the independent voters. And you hear pundits say this is a big voting block, a key voting block, the swing voters. Both parties need these folks in the election. What's your take then, Frank, on these independent voters and whether they really swing as much as some would make you believe?
Well, by definition, when we say an independent voter, these are men and women that when we call them on the phone and we say, as of today, do you identify yourself as a Republican, a Democrat, or an independent? These are the people who say independent on the phone.
And people like to say that.
Yeah. In fact, it's higher now. I had a graph when we were talking up at Iliad at Dartmouth yesterday where we showed it used to be in the 50s and 60s, the majority of Americans were Democrats because we had a lot of white Democrats down in the South that disappeared after the 60s and 70s. But nowadays, the top bar, if you graph party ID, is independents, not either of the parties, but 40% plus of Americans now identify as independents. So that's certainly increasing. However, that's their initial reaction, kind of expressing a skepticism. But we clever pollsters follow up and say to these independents, now, do you lean one way or the other? And
right.
In fact, most of them will lean either Republican or Democrat. And then when we look at their behavior, like who you're going to vote for in positions on issues, they look very similar to the people who initially identified as Republicans or Democrats. So we have people who initially want to say I'm independent, but underneath it all have strong currents one way or the other. So what you have left is a sliver of people, sometimes single digits, 10%, who are true independents, don't lean. But actually, when you look at those in a political environment, they're less likely to vote. They're more likely to be apathetic to the whole system of you know, they're retreating to their farms in rural Vermont, let's say, right? And they're just out of the system altogether. That's who's left over is true. So, you know, there's some nice pieces now looking. We may have fewer undecided voters now in this election. I say nice pieces of analysis which have looked at it. We may have fewer people now who are truly undecided than in previous elections, which really means Romney and Obama more so than previous elections, are out there trying to increase motivation.
Get the base out.
Yeah, rather than there are just not that many people probably that are moving dramatically one way or the other.
That's real interesting. Our leading pollster in this state, Andy Smith at UNH, often says what you say, Frank. Most independents are independent in name only, that just 10%, maybe even less, are truly independent. And it seems like you're saying a lot of those folks, small slice though they may be, aren't even going to bother to vote. So why do all this swing voter courting when the swing voters maybe don't even exist?
Yeah, that's right. Well, 3 or 4% can make a difference. Look at Florida back in 2000. So I think if you had on Obama and Romney strategists, they would say there's still enough of them, although small, in some of these very, very close states that could make a difference. But I would say if you had the aforementioned strategists and interviewed them, they would probably say their emphasis is more now on turnout, that the way to win an election is to get your people to turn out more so than convincing people that might have been voting for the other guy to now vote for your guy.
Interesting.
And that's why you have Obama very shrewdly, his campaign staff, had him go through a series of pronouncements which played to various groups. You know, you'll see him playing to women, then he made the announcement about same-sex marriage. So he's kind of gone down the list. He made a lot of announcements about immigration for Hispanic. He's gone down the list trying to say to each of these groups that typically swing Democratic, I like you, I'm in sympathy with you, please turn out and vote for me. Wow. And Romney has to do the same thing.
Well, here's a comment on our Facebook page from Georgian who says, what about the youth, 18 to 24-year-olds, maybe college kids? Are they as polarized as everyone else? Great comment, Georgian. Thank you.
No, they're not as polarized. The youth today are identified as they're more likely to be independent and out of the system. But if they do have political leanings, they clearly lean to the left in the sense that they're more likely to be Democratic and vote for Obama, although a lot of them aren't plugged into the system. So I don't think they're probably as polarized if we look at those measures as are other people. The trouble with young people is they're just not settled into the political system yet. They're on the move. They're not registered to vote. They're less plugged in, and they're less likely to vote. And that's a problem because he was able to generate enthusiasm out of the group disproportionately in 08. But our data so far suggests that he's not getting the same level of enthusiasm, and that's a problem because he needs them to turn out and vote.
So they may not vote for Romney, but they may just sit
home.
That's
right. Now, you know, all generalizations are bad. How's that, right? there are young people voting for Romney, so we're talking about Tennessee. But absolutely, if you do rank order by age, young people swing to Obama and older people 65-plus swing to Romney.
All right. Well, lots more to talk about after a short break. And we'll keep taking your calls, emails, comments on our Facebook page. 1-800-892-6477 is the number. Keep it right here.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Grapponi Auto Group, featuring multiple lines of fuel-efficient, environmentally friendly cars at Grapponi Auto Junction in Bow and online 24 hours a day at grapponi.com. And from Hospice at HCS, providing comfort, care, and support for people with advanced illness in southwestern New Hampshire. From offices in Keene, Peterborough, and Charlestown, hcsservices.org. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
NHPR's summer car raffle may be on its way out, but there's plenty of time left in the season to enjoy the prizes. The Trek bike from S&W Sports comes with a roof-mounted rack for your car so you can take it on vacation with you. And the kayak from Portsmouth Kayak Adventures is a great way to explore New Hampshire's many waterways. But get your tickets today at nhpr.org or call 1-888-805-NHPR. And good luck.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, Mitt Romney's running mate. We discuss the vice presidential possibilities with an announcement expected sometime soon. Email us who you'd choose for Mitt Romney's running mate at exchange@nhpr.org. And be sure to join us tomorrow morning live at 9. Today in The Exchange, Gallup editor-in-chief Frank Newport is here talking about the political polarization he sees in the polling his organization does. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Do you think the political divides that we see in Congress and at our state houses is trickling down to all Americans, or do you think the polarization is exaggerated, that people still get along at the community level? Also, is this divide a net negative for our country? Or is it just part of our political traditions to debate and disagree on core convictions? Let us know what you think. 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And Frank, let's go right back to our callers. And Barbara's calling from Wakefield. Hi, Barbara. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I just have a question about how we actually govern. Given the polarization and the unwillingness of politicians to compromise to get anything done, what's going to happen? I mean, is there something that can happen?
The fiscal cliff, for example, Barbara. Mm-hmm. We've heard a lot about that lately. Yeah, thanks for calling in. Go ahead, Frank.
Yeah, great question. And when we look at our trend, I wish I could show everybody our trend graphs on a lot of indicators like satisfaction with the way things are going, confidence in the country. They all fell off a cliff last August when we had the debt ceiling debate,
right,
which was really a calamity as far as Americans were concerned. And it took a long time to recover from that in our data, which is indicative of the looming problems for the American public's perspective if, in fact, after the election, they dither and can't get things done and all these consequences happen. And maybe not even so much that these things happen, like the tax cuts all drop off or that we have the sequestering that's going to happen that was set in motion a couple of years ago. Not so much that they happen, but that Congress lets them happen without thinking about it, because all these default things have been put in place by politicians who kicked the can down the field previously are going to happen. I think Americans will be very disappointed that Congress can't say we're going to do this, but do it deliberately. So I think that's a major issue. But our data actually show that the average American, if you average it together, wants more compromise. In answer to her question, we gave people a 5-point scale and says one is our elected representatives should stick to their beliefs and principles even and not compromise. Others said, no, you should give in on your beliefs and principles in order to compromise. And we said, where would you think the optimal situation would be on that 1-5? And we found the American public tilting towards the compromise size of the agenda. Even 3 are moving in that direction. So if you just took a referendum on it, all Americans went to the polls, they would say to their men and women in Washington, compromise. Now, the big interesting finding in that is that it skews to the right on the opposite direction. Tea Party members, conservatives, and Republicans are significantly more likely to say don't compromise. So they're of this belief that it's important to stick to principles even if the system crumbles. And, you know, they bring up historical examples of we've admired people in history, right, who stick to their beliefs regardless. If our founding fathers had compromised with the king in England, we wouldn't have had the U.S. You know, there are a lot of examples where they revere people to stick to their – but that's clearly a belief that's more prevalent on the right than the left, that when they send people to Washington, they want them to stick to the beliefs and shake things up even if the system crumbles to some degree. Left, the Democrats, non-Tea Party supporters are more likely to say compromise. But let me repeat that when you put it all together and took a vote, you would have a majority of Americans saying to Washington, compromise.
Well, okay. I'm skeptical. They say – they compromise, they say. But if you, I think, and you know more about this than me, Frank, if you went through it piece by piece, you know, people say they compromise. People say that they, you know, that they tell their doctors that they exercise 3 times a week. You know what I mean? I think people say things to make themselves sound good to a pollster who calls on the phone. But you're still electing these folks from the right and the left who are unwilling to compromise.
Well, I'm shocked that you would say Americans don't always say exactly what's the truth. Yeah, that's an interesting topic in and of itself. You may be right to some degree when it comes. That's like Americans saying we certainly want government spending to be cut back, but don't cut
Social security.
People so there's
say
some
they
of
want
that
compromise.
In there.
But if they really wanted it, would they keep voting these folks in?
Yeah, I take people at their word that at least in theory, you know, philosophically, the majority of Americans think there should be more compromise up there, even if these elected representatives have to pull back on their principles. And that's what I think we're seeing from the majority of Americans. But as I say, you're much less likely to get that out of people who identify themselves as Republicans or Tea Party supporters.
Our phone number again on the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And here's an email from Matt in Nottingham. He says, I'm frustrated hearing reporting on polls that ask ambiguous questions, such as whether people are satisfied with the overall direction the country is going in. I feel this translates to the public when reported to mean, essentially, should we kick out the incumbents or not? But a person answering the question with, no, I'm not satisfied, can easily mean, to take our current situation for an example. No, the opposition won't let the president achieve his agenda, so I'm not satisfied. But that negative answer is reported and understood by the public as meaning, no, I'm not satisfied with the president, and lots of swing voters like to pick a winner, so they'll adopt what they interpret as the overall sentiment. He says this ambiguity is mucking things up. I think I get where he's going with this email, Frank, the idea that if you called Jane and said, Jane, are you satisfied with the country and the direction it's going? And Jane says no, you might interpret that as a vote against the president since he's in charge. But maybe Jane isn't satisfied because she's mad at the Republicans for not letting the president achieve his agenda. That seems to be what Matt is saying.
Well, there's a lot in there, right?
That's yes.
A very, very intricate email on his part, Facebook posting or whatever its source was there. Lot to think about there. But we do ask summary questions, but we go further than that. And he's absolutely right, of course, that if somebody says you are not satisfied with the way things are going, that doesn't tell us in and of itself why they're not satisfied with the way things are going. And it could be people on the right, and it could be people on the left for a variety of different reasons. So I think he's absolutely right. But we're not dumb. We go further than that, clearly. We don't simply report the one number, but we try to report a lot of other data and look at Democrats and Republicans and things along these lines to get a better sense of what's going on when people tell us they're not satisfied overall. But we do know, in historically, in answer to his question, there's empirical evidence that that satisfaction measure in and of itself, just like the simple measure to approve or disapprove of the way the president's handling his job, are predictive of who wins the election. So regardless of what's behind satisfaction, we know historically that if lower percent of Americans are satisfied, the incumbent has a higher chance of being thrown out of office. So Obama would want the satisfaction to be higher, even though there may be some hidden liberals in there who are saying dissatisfied for a variety of reasons that have nothing to do with disliking Obama. There is empirical evidence that it's a good predictive measure.
I see. That's interesting. Matt, I appreciate the email because it's important to kind of tease out what is in those broader numbers. So even if there are some people like Matt in those numbers, in general, high levels of dissatisfaction are not good for a sitting president.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely correct. And low job approval rating, you know, which is a very good indicator. In fact, that's the single best indicator, you know, up until September probably, of an incumbent's chances of being reelected. It's a very simple question. Do you approve or disapprove of the way he's doing his job? And when Carter and George H.W. Bush were thrown out of office, both had job approval ratings at about this point that were down into the 30%, and even Bush got down to 20%, and Obama's higher than that, which is good. But Obama is not above 50%, which is where he would want to be for comfortable reelection.
You don't want to return to something you mentioned earlier, Frank, and that is the important role of religiosity in partisan feelings. You're writing a forthcoming book on that coming out in December, God is Alive and Well, Religion in America. Give us a little bit more, if you could, please, on this correlation between faith and politics.
Yeah, it began, the evidence shows it started in the 80s and has accelerated since then. But I often say now that if a person's walking towards me on the street, and the person is white, because as I mentioned earlier, African-Americans are very fascinating because they are the most religious race or ethnic group in America, and they're also the most democratic.
More so than Hispanics.
Absolutely. Yeah. Hispanics are likely to be Catholic, but blacks, even in fact, in our data, we have 18-year-old blacks who are already more religious than 18-year-old blacks of any other religion, and 85-year-old blacks are more religious than 85-year-olds of any other race, not religion. So it's embedded in the culture, a lot of reasons for it, but African-Americans are the most religious group in America and also the most democratic. So they confuse the pattern. So we take them out of the analysis, and if you look at whites and somebody walks to me in the street, I say, how often do you go to church? And they say, oh, I go to church services every week. I say, all right, you're a Republican. And that's a pretty good chance. That question in and of itself is probably gives me as good a predictor of their politics as
really?
Any other question.
That's
other
strong.
Than, yeah, it's that strong.
Nine
it's
out of ten
strong,
times you're right.
Well, I wouldn't go quite that far. But it certainly increases my probability of making an accurate assessment of their politics. So there's a very strong relationship. The Democratic Party and Obama supporters fairly strongly tend to be people who we classify as non-religious. Don't attend religious services and say religion's not important in their daily lives. Republicans is where highly religious people have moved in the recent decades, and they're very strongly on that side of the spectrum today.
And why is that?
Well, I think it's what I mentioned earlier. There's been an intermating of it goes both ways. Republicans have taken advantage of this, of religious people, and religious people have sought a party that's sympathetic to their interests. So it's worked both ways. And a lot of it has to do with the religious, highly religious Americans are concerned about structure, it looks like in the data. They like sense of yes and no on morality, and they're looking for a party that gives them that type of answer. And the Democrats, by definition, are more likely to say, it's not up to us to make judgments on personal moral decisions. Good examples on abortion or on same-sex marriage. And religious people, because religion in and of itself says this is right and this is wrong. There's a heaven, there's a hell. You know, there's Ten Commandments. Highly religious people have a mindset that is more likely to say there is right or wrong in life, and therefore they're more willing to say this morality, abortion or same-sex marriage, is right or wrong, and the Republican Party has catered to those interests and built this bond.
Have you done any polling, Frank, lately on how Republican voters today feel about Mitt Romney's Mormonism? This was an issue during the primary, somewhat more of an issue 4 years ago than it is now.
Yeah, we still have about, same as 67, you know, about 2 out of 10, roughly, Americans overall saying they won't vote for a Mormon for president. That was true in 67 when George Romney was running, Mitt's father, for president. That's when Gallup first asked the question. We haven't seen any change in that, which is fascinating.
Wait, back up. I'm fascinated by that. In 1967, when George Romney ran for president, how many Americans said they wouldn't vote for a Mormon?
It was about 2 out of 10. It said, and here's the way we phrase it at Gallup. We said, if an otherwise well-qualified person who happened to be a Mormon was running for president, and by the way, we asked that also, fill in the blanks, black, woman, Jew, Catholic. You know, we've asked it over the years about a variety of atheists. People, but we ask it about a Mormon back then, and most of those other ones I just mentioned have changed. You know, it used to be a minority of Americans that vote for a woman, and now it's 90% plus, but we've had no movement on the Mormon question. In 67, it was about 2 out of 10. We've asked it several times in the last year. It's still about 2 out of 10 who say they won't vote for a Mormon. But in answer to your question, I think Republicans, that's a minor issue. Their interest in electing one of their own and not Barack Obama is so strong that even if they're a conservative, highly evangelical Christian who typically has some issues with the Mormon faith, they would say, I don't care. I'm voting for Mitt Romney despite that because other things are more powerful. So I don't think that's an issue for Republican voters at all, and I don't think it's much of an issue for Democratic voters. It's more of an issue, by the way, for Mitt Romney. I think it prevents him from talking a lot about his background. You know, he and his advisors, he doesn't feel comfortable going into a lot about his personal family and his saga and all that because he doesn't want to raise the issue. So I think it limits Mitt Romney some because he's trying to constantly be on edge to not really get into his religion. So I think that may be an issue in that sense. But I don't see his Mormonism as a highly impactful issue in the voting.
Let's take one more call if we could, Frank. And this is Richard in Amherst. Hi, Richard, you're on the air. Go ahead. Thanks for joining us.
I've got a question actually based on an observation over the past quarter of a century. I've noticed that it seems that now a lot of the more conservative people that I know seem to be much more scared of the world around them, the Hispanics invading from the South and communists and socialists in Europe and Canada and Asia, while the more liberals seem to say, well, we've got a problem, but we can fix it. And it's sort of exemplified by the changes in the farmers here in New Hampshire. If you go back a quarter of a century, almost every farmer was a Republican and fairly conservative.
Hey, Richard,
and now
I've got a question for you.
Yeah.
You know, we did a series on immigration back in May, and boy, if you think people used to be scared of, you know, outsiders, back then we had whole political parties devoted to, you know, getting rid of foreigners, so to speak, and riots and fights in the streets over immigration and stuff. So I think that those tendencies have always been there, and maybe they're not as bad as they used to be. I don't know. What do you think, Richard? Did you catch any of that?
Yeah, I did. And that certainly may be the case. But it's just sort of the change that I've noticed, you know, over the past couple of decades. And it may have been the case in the past as well.
Okay.
But I guess the thing that I've noticed is sort of the division between more liberal and more conservative folks in the area.
So you do see the divide. All right. So he's reflecting upon what you've seen in your polling, too.
I guess so. It's hard to say we're more xenophobic or worried now than we used to be. Think about the communists and our fear of communists in the 50s and 60s and how huge that was. And there's been a great deal of fear and antipathy towards immigrant groups going back for centuries in this country. So I don't know there's a lot of data that would support exactly how much that has changed, but the interesting thoughts.
Thanks, Richard, for the call. And, you know, you spoke, I believe, yesterday morning up at Dartmouth as part of the Iliad Summer Lecture Series. It's about polarization. That's the theme this year. Every year they adopt a different theme, and polarization is the theme this year. And the headline introducing the series, Frank, says, "A Dangerously Divided America." What do you think? Is it dangerous to be divided?
I tend to not make value judgments. You know, the people who put Iliad together certainly put that in the title, and that's certainly an interesting viewpoint and probably provocative and gets more people to show up, which is certainly an interesting perhaps reason for the, for their view on that perspective. But I'm not so sure that I would say dangerous. You know, I tend to have a lot of respect and optimism about the American people. So I think, you know, whatever's happening out here has probably happened before historically. We've been divided before, and I think we'll work our way through it overall. So I, based on data at any rate, which is my way of looking at the world rather than giving my opinion, I'm not sure I personally would say dangerous. I would just say it's a fascinating phenomenon, and we need to keep analyzing it.
Just like a sociologist. I'm observing it. I'm not making value judgments.
Well, I probably to a fault sometimes, my family and friends would tell me, but that's my way of looking at the world.
Do you care to predict the future for us, Frank, on this political polarization? Are we still going to, you know, if we sat down with you 5 years from now, would you still say, Laura, we're more polarized than ever? Or would you say, you know, we've kind of seen a pullback from this polarization trend?
Well, that's an excellent question. Let's meet in 5 years and we'll have an answer for you. But I don't know. I think a lot of it will depend on the economy. The economy is booming in 5 years. We'll have less polarization. But let's make a date and meet in 5 years and we'll know.
All right. Well, Frank, it's been great to meet you. Thank you so much for coming in. We really appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure.
That's Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at Gallup. His forthcoming book is called God is Alive and Well, Religion in America. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. We say goodbye and a hearty thank you to our intern, Claudia Camarino, today. Claudia will miss your sense of humor, your insight, your hard work. Good luck as you head back to college in Maine. Our other intern is Tim Camerato. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, a running mate for Mitt Romney. Many are playing the guessing game as to who his second-in-command might be, and lots